In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome to the iSpy Radio Show. Happy you're here with me. As every week, we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. On today's show, it's popping the balloon of globalism and the New World Order. If you're wondering why the left is rioting at everything right now, it's because they're like a spoiled teenager that really, really wanted a pony for Christmas. Except his parents didn't buy a pony, they bought him a tie. A Trump tie. Because he needed to get a job. And so he started smashing everyone else's presents. The left really, really thought Hillary was going to be president, and she was going to be the final brick in the foundation to build the House of Globalism on New World Order Street. And all that's gone away. They were so close to no borders. They were so close to all these government handouts at the expense of the rich, which really meant anyone with a job. They were going to get rich as the government handed out huge contracts to their political allies. And even better, government would finally be able to punish those on the other side. Climate change deniers, evil oil companies, and anyone who said or thought things that they didn't like. All of that suddenly taken away. And now a businessman is in office, and the speed with which he is dismantling their pipe dreams and building pipelines is causing their heads to split open and smash everyone else's Christmas presents. On today's show, we'll talk about a true businessman's approach to Washington. While we've had businessmen as presidents before, we have never had such a successful entrepreneur at the helm. An entrepreneur who wants to build things, and sometimes when you build, you have to tear things down. Like that New World Order. I'd like to welcome now Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's ALEC.org if you'd like to visit them. Jonathan, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me back, Mark. Good to be with you as always.
Yeah, and you know, what an exciting time too. We've got a business leader, and of course, you know, ALEC is all about promoting good business principles and free markets and everything else. And now you have finally have somebody in office that understands those issues and their importance. I mean, you live in the Beltway area. Is the amount of uproar during the first few days of a new president taking office, is that surprising to people that live there?
Well, I guess to some degree, although I guess coming through this campaign, we kind of expected this was kind of a disruption a year, right, when it comes to elections and shaking up the status quo. And of course, draining the swamp was one of the big themes of the campaign. And so to some extent, you know, this was expected that, you know, that's one of the reasons why the American people have trusted now Donald Trump as president of the United States and his administration is to come and change things. Clearly, the last 8 years were not working for a good portion of America. And I think, you know, people are ready for a change. And certainly the last weekend of Inauguration Day was a strange, wild weekend around here.
Yeah, it sure was. You had riots on one side and other people celebrating. I mean, what a crazy mix.
Well, it sure was. And, you know, I think that you look at just for me, it's taking a step back. And this is my home community now. I've been here over a decade and seeing, you know, some of those bands of anarchist protesters, anti-capitalist communists just going through and smashing windows and just torching limousines. I mean, it was really unreal to see that kind of violence and kind of anger out there just because we have a new administration while the rest of the nation was celebrating a peaceful transition of authority from one regime to another. We had these disruptors out there. And the irony of all ironies, of course, was they were going down downtown D.C. smashing windows. They had to stop and smash a Starbucks window. You would think that these guys are all like Starbucks drinkers, right?
Wow. Yeah, well, I guess they're indiscriminate in that way. But, you know, I looked at those demonstrations and especially the riots, and I thought this is indicative that too many people have too much time on their hands. And, you know, we still have over 95 million people not participating in the workforce, and I'm looking for that to change rather quickly. And but in terms of the congressional members that I assume you've been having some meetings with, what's the tone like around the Capitol right now?
Well, the tone around the Capitol is optimism, certainly, from the free market fellows that, ladies and gentlemen, that we're talking with up there, and some cautious optimism. Obviously, when it comes to some big picture reforms that are needed for this nation's economy to recover with this basically non-existent recovery we've had coming out of the 2009 downturn, there are some big picture heavy lifts that have to be done, as you know, Mark, on tax reform, on regulatory relief, on federalism, on those type of issues. These are issues that don't happen every session of Congress. You have to go back to Ronald Reagan in 1986 to find the last time we significantly remade our federal tax code. Mm-hmm. And so while there is a whole degree of optimism, I think that's rightly placed because you have an administration that's going to have a very pro-business, free market outlook on many things, I think rightly there's also a bit of caution to say, let's not overpromise and underdeliver here. Let's make sure that we take things methodically and get things worked out with the biggest barriers, hopefully coming first on Obamacare and some of those issues.
Well, certainly what we've seen so far has been very encouraging for those of us in the free market camp and business-oriented camp. But it's interesting, you know, this weekend will mark the end of only his second full week. And in some ways, it seems like he's been there a month or more, just considering the substance of his actions so far and also this very forceful new direction. We saw it on immigration and the so-called Muslim ban, which, of course, it wasn't a Muslim ban, and some of these other executive orders. Is there a concern from congressional members on President Trump's speed and whether or not Congress can actually keep up with him? And I guess my question is, are they trying to speed up their own processes or are they trying to slow Trump down?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on certain things, I mean, I think there's been so many things built up over the last 8 years that conservatives had wanted to get done but were stymied, of course, with the inhibitor of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue there on the other end of town. And things like, for instance, what should be a no-brainer in terms of a policy victory, Keystone XL pipeline, and to have that done within the first week via executive order. And you can tell the Trump White House is going down the kind of the checklist of the 200-some promises that they made during the campaign, and they're trying to get some very early wins and show momentum. And I think, you know, many people have seen that as a sign of strength. Certainly Congress is going to have their time on the bigger policy issues when it comes to budgets and taxes and Obamacare replacement or repeal standalone, that they're going to have their time. They're going to have to weigh in. It's going to have to go through regular order. But there are some things that have just built up, Mark, over these years that needed to be done right away, like Keystone XL for sure.
Sure, sure. Let's go ahead and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. We're going to have more with Jonathan Williams talking about new leadership in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. Jonathan Williams is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform. You know, that's really a mouthful of a title there you got there, Jonathan.
Yeah, I've been called worse, so you can call me anything you'd like, Mark. So.
Well, he is with the American Legislative Exchange Council, better known as ALEC, A-L-E-C, and we're talking about new business-focused leadership in Washington, D.C., and how that is shaking up Washington in a good way. And, you know, we were talking about the processes there in Congress and how they may be struggling to keep up with President Trump. And hopefully they're going to start streamlining some of their processes because we have seen a real sense of urgency but also energy coming out of the White House and really kind of a new way of doing business. And I think a good example of that is what happened with this immigration executive order. It came down over the weekend. It seemed to catch a lot of people by surprise. And to me, that was indicative of somebody that has a lot of business leadership, because the way that Washington is set up now, they have to field test things, they have to run through policies, and they run it by all of these different groups and stuff to get their input. I mean, it could be months before a policy is finally put into place. In business, you don't do that. It seems to be, for a lot of businesses, some action, even if it's wrong, some action is better than no action, which is what Washington seems to want. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's certainly going to be a period, especially early on in the Trump administration, where there's probably going to be some tension on what he is used to as a business leader and what he's done during his successful business career versus how Washington works, right, and how kind of the deliberative process of D.C. and some would call it bureaucratic and horribly slow and inefficient process works. And so I think you're going to see some of that play out. You know, one of the issues that comes to play when it comes to some of these early executive orders is the way that liberals have of recent boycotted some of the confirmation hearings to get some of these vital positions filled in the cabinet and other Senate confirmed positions. I just saw the news this week of Tom Price, a great nominee, by the way, for Health and Human Service Secretary. Being boycotted. Steve Mnuchin over at Treasury, another solid private sector expert coming in to lead the financial side, being completely stonewalled by liberals in Congress. And so without those people in place, I think it's going to be a lot more tension, right? And so once we get some of the important key positions here filled, I think it's going to run a little bit smoother going forward.
Well, I certainly hope so, and certainly with Price, what we saw was the Democrats basically boycotting it and not even attending the committee meetings, and I think Orrin Hatch did the right thing. He says, you know what, if you're not going to show up, we're going to vote anyway. And,
well, let's not forget, this is a gift that Harry Reid gave Republicans on his way out, was, you know, he waived the supermajority requirement for confirmation of presidential appointments to lead agency head and cabinet agencies. And so then the old rules, many of these nominees may have been stopped, right? And so we can all thank Harry Reid for making it much easier to get a much more conservative cabinet. This may, Mark, be the most conservative cabinet in American history, looking at Betsy DeVos, Tom Price, down the line, some very, very qualified free market people to lead these agencies.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's exceptionally encouraging, certainly to people there at ALEC. I have to imagine that's very encouraging. It's interesting, though, just watching him go about business. You know, I mentioned the immigration executive order that, you know, it's better to take some action, even if it's imperfect, than no action whatsoever, rather than waiting months and months and months. I just imagine having a businessman in an office like Trump is highly encouraging to ALEC rather than a community organizer or career politician. ALEC is all about capitalism, expanding markets and competition. So do you expect ALEC's strategies and abilities to push through some legislation has a more positive future here? I mean, what are your thoughts on all this?
Well, you know, we have been around for more than 40 years. We've had some great relationships with past administrations like President Reagan, who asked us to help run his federalism initiative back in the 80s, had some very strong relationships in the George W. Bush administration as well. But when you look at kind of the cast of leaders within this administration so far, we've got some great ALEC connections. Some of our opponents have been sniping that this is an ALEC administration because there's so many ties from free market leaders in the states. For people like Tom Price, for instance, who's an ALEC alumni, used to be a state legislative leader in the Georgia Senate, was active ALEC member, now going to be running one of the most important agencies to dismantle this albatross of Obamacare on the economy. So we're very optimistic to see how we can continue to have our ideas, make their way through Washington. We've got about 100 members of the current Congress who are ALEC alumni members from when they served in the state legislatures. And so while we aren't going to be pushing legislation on them, we're more than happy for them to be taking ideas of the things we've developed over the years and putting them into action.
Right, right. And what a different future you guys face now with Trump in office versus what you might have faced had Hillary gotten there.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's all about today seeing, what can be proactively done on free market issues where, perhaps under a Clinton administration, much of the time would have been defending against more big government failed ideas that have failed for the last 8 years. And it's one of the reasons, Mark, why we've had...
But this time it'll work.
Right, exactly. Yeah. If it was just done differently, liberalism would have worked, right? And it's just like, the defense of communism is just that the Soviet Union didn't do it correctly.
Yes,
and
yes.
The implementation was wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned that this has been called an ALEC administration. In fact, your CEO, Lisa Nelson, had sent out an email responding to that because on the inauguration day, one of the groups that is opposed to you said, we're about to swear in an ALEC administration. As if picking ALEC's best friend Mike Pence as his VP wasn't enough, now Donald Trump has filled his cabinet with ALEC supporters from top to bottom. And, I'm sorry, but, that's the results of an election. And I think what they're going to continue to snipe. They're going to continue to bemoan every little thing that Trump does. But what a great future we have in front of us if we can start getting some of these real free market principles put in place.
Well, and the key is this is a time in our history that free market conservatives need to show that the policies that they govern with are policies that will benefit the average man and woman across the United States. And if Republicans who are now in power in the state level and in Washington don't deliver, then shame on them. And the pendulum will probably swing pretty quickly in the other direction. But this is a huge opportunity for free market policies to make a difference and to rescue this economy and this nation from a very difficult past decade or decade and a half, which we've seen really no real growth, as you know, Mark.
Yes.
And wages have stagnated. And this is a reason that I think so many people were looking for a change. Once again, we had hope and change in 2008 that didn't turn out to be so much on the hope or change amount. And people, once again, this was a change election and people are looking for that.
Yes, absolutely. 8 years without 1 year of 3% growth or more. That's pretty shocking. Okay, everyone stay with us. We're taking a break now, but coming back, we're going to be talking about the new era of globalism. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is a vice president for ALEC, that is American Legislative Exchange Council. And Jonathan, I'd like to talk a little bit about the new era of globalism under a Trump administration. President Trump has said he wants to buy American and hire American. He wants companies to find a way to either bring their factories back to the U.S. or build here rather than have that knee-jerk reaction to build overseas. Some of this means that the president needs to help make America a more competitive and desirable place for companies to do business. You and I have talked a lot about how the states are 50 test tubes of competition, and now we're seeing this on a national level. The U.S. is competing among roughly 190 nations for business. So let's talk about what he needs to do to make us more competitive and attractive for businesses. On a federal level, what are some of the things that he can be, what are some of the steps he can be doing to make that happen?
Well, in when you set up the question, I think you hit the nail on the head, which is looking for ways to make America more competitive again, right? And so, you know, for instance, starting with regulation, which could perhaps get us nearly a percentage point on GDP growth if done correctly on regulatory reform. Maybe the most important thing for our economy to do is to start to rule back some of this executive rulemaking done by EPA, Department of Labor, and other very burdensome regulations on job creators. But secondly, when it comes to the global perspective, our United States companies, and we've talked about this a lot, Mark, as you know, is our United States companies face the highest corporate income taxes in the world today.
Yes.
And there's really no rational reason why companies should be inverting, like we've seen this craze of companies basically renouncing their U.S. Domicile and going overseas for tax reasons. There are so many inherent advantages to be a United States company. We are doing, unfortunately, because of liberal policies, doing everything as a nation to basically shove the countries out to Europe or even Canada in the case of Burger King, and it basically in the process shipping jobs, shipping profits overseas when at a time when it's very easy on a corporate rate reduction side to become more competitive. I mean, the corporate income tax hardly brings in any of the federal revenue. And so getting that rate down to a 15% like the Trump administration would like or 20% like Congress has been talking about is a fairly easy lift on the revenue side. And it would do wonders to turning around this outward migration of business and capital outside of the United States.
Well, absolutely. And I have to imagine that when he's having that press conference there and he's saying to these business leaders that he would like to have a 75% cut in regulations, I mean, that's not only encouraging, that's astounding if we can even get anywhere near 75% cut in regulations.
Well, and this is exactly why I believe the Dow has hit all-time records, surpassed 20,000, and has been on an upward trajectory ever since November, is because business leaders and the market looks at expectations, right? And they're expecting that the Trump administration will come in, disrupt this horrible regulatory overreach, cut corporate taxes and individual taxes, and make America more competitive again. And that's exactly what the Dow is looking for and what investors need to keep this market moving in the right direction. So it's been very encouraging. And I can't help but to point out that our old friend Paul Krugman, who's been wrong on almost everything economics related for the last decade or two now, he was, remember what he said after the election was, if Donald Trump wins, this economy is going to crash and never recover again. So once again, Paul Krugman, former Enron advisor, proven absolutely wrong.
Yeah, but that's probably why he works at the New York Times. Wow.
That's right. He's renounced his economist credentials and now is just a political hack, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, let's talk about taxes there, because this is something that the left tries to bludgeon people with, especially politicians, in the sense that they pose this as whether or not corporations are paying their fair share, and that they're not supporting the government, which means they're not supporting the poor and everything else. But it's really a misnomer, because it's not that corporations don't want to pay taxes. It's that taxes prevent them from growing their profits. It prevents them from hiring new people. It prevents them from doing more research and development, all the things that would add to their bottom line, which means that they'd have even more taxes to be able to pay. So how do you start transforming that there from in the Washington circles, in terms of, okay, it's not that they're not paying taxes, it's that you're essentially allowing them to spend on things that make them more profitable?
Yeah. Well, and first of all, going back to Econ 101 on this, and as Art Laffer would say, this isn't rocket surgery, Mark.
Yes.
You know, this is pretty standard economics, is when you tax something, you get less of it, right? And so making a dollar in the United States is how many percentage point more expensive than making a dollar in profitability anywhere else in the world. That right there gives you the direct incentive to not take profits in the United States. That's why we've got, by some reports, several trillion dollars of profits sitting outside waiting to be brought back into the United States when there's a more competitive tax system to bring it back. But secondly, at the end of the day, businesses don't pay taxes, people do.
Yes.
And that's an often forgotten point, is that when there's this whole uproar about businesses supposedly needing to pay their fair share, is we forget that businesses are just a pass-through when it comes to taxes. Sure, they cut the check and it does affect their competitiveness, where they take profitability, but they need to pass that on to the workers in form of lower wages, consumers in the form of higher prices, or shareholders who are people like their 401ks looking for that retirement return. And so it's so important to not demonize business in this process, because at the end of the day, they're just a pass-through for profits, and it's individuals that are stuck with these corporate tax burdens. And the other final point on that is, when tax rates get too high, and this is back to the Laffer curve, companies leave, and, you know, paying, let's say, 35% here versus 12.5% in Ireland at the corporate rate, 35% of nothing is how much, Mark? It's nothing, because when companies move, we get absolutely zero in corporate revenue of tax. And that's the important point. We're missing out. I think we would see a real Laffer curve effect if rates are reduced, and we'd actually see some income of new revenue.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think any businessman is going to say, you know, if I'm getting a $10 million cut in taxes, I would much rather hire new people, do more research, and all the rest, rather than pay that to the government. Let's take a break a little early, because coming back, I want to talk to you a little bit about the importance of repealing and replacing Obamacare. Stay with us. Lots more with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, that's ALEC.org if you'd like to go visit them. ALEC's mission is to discuss, develop, and disseminate model public policies that expand free markets, promote economic growth, limit the size of government, and preserve individual liberty. All very admirable goals as far as I'm concerned. And we're talking to ALEC, Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform, Jonathan Williams. And going out of that break, we're talking about Obamacare, or that I mentioned that I'd like to talk about Obamacare. Repealing and replacing, this is the granddaddy of all regulations. What would this mean for U.S. companies in terms of their ability to be more competitive in the world market?
Well, it's a big deal, not only because of the tax implications that companies are facing because of the extra Obamacare taxes, as you have a huge issue in terms of overall quality of care for their employees. You have the issue of whether they can afford to keep employees on care as part of their compensation package. Premiums have gone up so dramatically. I know internally our premiums have gone up so dramatically after being told that we could keep our insurance if we like it. We can't afford to insurance anymore,
yeah.
Right? And we've had to change insurance plans. And I know so many other small businesses have across the country, and many have really struggled with this decision, because what it's meant is they've had to put their employees out into the Obamacare exchanges to navigate on their own, which is not a thing that most employers want to do their employees, because it's not an easy thing to navigate, as we've found out over the last couple of years. And so you're replacing this, with the cost going up as quickly as they are, making America more competitive again when it comes the tax side of it, all very, very important to the piece of competitiveness and having a healthcare system that can really deliver results.
And one of the big issues on that is the high cost of drugs. And in fact, the high cost of drugs is often blamed or that's the excuse really for the high cost of healthcare as well. I imagine it was probably encouraging to you to see these drug companies meeting with President Trump because so many of these are overseas in terms of their productions. Talk to us a little bit in terms of how you see some of those regulations coming down and helping to really drive down the prices of drugs.
Well, I mean, obviously what we need to get back down to is a market-driven healthcare system. We've gotten so far away from that and gotten into this third-party payer model that I know we've talked about in the past that, you know, people have no concern over costs. There's no really cost controls. I mean, while more people have been covered perhaps because of Obamacare, the quality of care as well as the cost has been way out of control. And so to have a president that's willing to sit down both with the business leaders on the healthcare industry side, as well as taxpayer groups and other groups, I think is going to be what it takes to really kind of move the ball forward on this. And in terms of where it goes, there's a lot of discussion on repeal and replace versus just repeal certain of the most burdensome aspects, like the individual mandate, which, of course, in my mind, and I think the minds of many, is still constitutionally suspect, and getting rid of some of the very worst barriers of it, and then allowing somebody like Tom Price over at HHS, who, by the way, has had a conservative alternative for healthcare reform in many Congresses. You know, the other side will often say, well, there's no conservative position, and what's their plan? Well, Tom Price has had legislation in the last several Congresses to replace this regime with something that's more market and patient focused. And I think, you know, giving him this opportunity at HHS is really perhaps a once in a lifetime opportunity to get things back on track for U.S. healthcare.
Yes, and what a relief. Although, you know, the Democrats didn't read Obamacare, you can't expect them to have read Tom Price's plan either. So
that's right. They had to pass it while the ink was drying before they read it.
Yes, yes. Boy, oh boy. One of the other issues that Trump has made a big push on is not only cutting back immigration and whatnot, but also it was announced earlier this week, leaked really, that he's looking at signing an executive order that would curb H-1B visas. And probably also J-1 visas, because that's something else that he had promised there in his during his campaign. H-1Bs, in case people aren't aware, that favors foreign technology workers, especially, over American university graduates because they can be hired at lower salaries. And the J-1s favor foreign youths, ironically enough, over inner-city youths. And so I imagine this would all be very good for the American worker. What is Alex's positions on these?
Well, first of all, I mean, ALEC doesn't get into the immigration issue as an organization. However, you know, some of my perspective on this is, you know, looking, for instance, at what are the skills that are needed in the marketplace. And there's a couple of ways to address that. First of all, and I think President Trump and many in his administration are really good on this aspect, is the idea of training more Americans for the jobs of today and tomorrow, instead of, you know, a lot of people going out for liberal arts degrees, and nothing wrong with that, by the way. But if, you know, you're going to spend $50,000 a year at a nice university getting a liberal arts degree and then struggling to find a job and working at Starbucks when you graduate, does that really behoove the American economy versus training so many people in the trades, for instance, and the skill sets that are needed for the jobs that are out there today and tomorrow? And then obviously on the immigration side, if there are jobs that Americans aren't coming up for whatever reason through the education system to fulfill, maybe looking at a skills-based profile for immigration. I know that there's been some work done on looking at the Canadian system and looking at some of the other systems from around the world that seem to have done a better job at matching up what's actually needed in the economy with foreign immigration versus what the American system has done. So I think there will be some discussion over both the illegal immigration side as well as the side of how do we rework the legal immigration side to make sure it's working for all Americans.
Yeah, I think that's great. I got about a minute and a half here with you. ALEC annually publishes Rich States, Poor States. That's your annual report. The ninth edition just came out. We'll have to have you back on to talk more in depth about all that. But looking ahead, what are some of the states that ALEC expects to really make some strides this year, states where you expect big things are on the horizon?
Well, even better than that is I can say there's been a few states with some really big victories so far, and I can look at a couple of others that we expect to do good things. First of all, Kentucky. This is the first Republican majority in really modern history in Kentucky. And within the first week of them being sworn in, they passed right to work in Kentucky, being the 27th right to work state. Not far behind them, Missouri, under a new conservative governor and a very conservative legislature, is now within the next week or so probably going to be right to work state number 28. And then our friends in Live Free or Die state of New Hampshire very well could be 29th right to work state before the end of the year. So we're seeing some very good pro taxpayer reforms pass in some states that have been looking at doing this for a very long time. Also, I mean, you look at now Republicans, and this isn't a partisan issue, obviously, but just for purposes of partisan identification, Republicans control 69 out of the 99 partisan chambers across the states today. So this is a high watermark for Republicans. Now, the question once again is, will they govern on the conservative principles on which they were elected? And that's a big question mark. But I think
unfortunately,
states like
you're right there. But the good news is that if they don't keep it conservative free market values, we know that ALEC will be there to hold their feet to the fire. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, good to be back with you, my friend.
And up next, Carl Higbee, a former SEAL. We're going to talk to him about that so-called Muslim ban, as well as that recent raid in Yemen. According to his Twitter profile, he is a red, white, and blue-blooded, flag-loving American, Navy SEAL, author, and Fox News and CNN commentator. I'm talking about Carl Higbee, who was also chairman of the George Washington Leadership Foundation. Carl, it's good to talk to you again.
Oh, good to be back on.
Yeah, and you know, with our previous guest, we discussed the fall of globalism in the Trump era, and one of the big tenets, of course, of globalism is no borders and unfettered immigration. But this, of course, creates a massive security risk, and President Trump fired a shot with his executive order this last weekend to temporarily halt inflows from seven countries where they have a high number of known terrorists. Trump talked about taking this kind of action his entire campaign. Why is it that this still seemed to catch so many people by surprise?
President Trump is the first president in the history of, I would say, America, that people are mad at him for actually upholding the promises he made on the campaign trail.
Yeah, good point. And, you know, so much of this has, so much about this executive order, excuse me, has been made by the Dems and some others who have criticized this. Using their words, they say this wasn't well planned or thought out. To me, what I saw was two things. One, you don't announce to your enemies your plans ahead of time. And two, this is a businessman's way of thinking. You make a decision and you go with it. And you worry about perfect later. That runs really opposite to so much of Washington's thinking, where you work out all the details and poll test it and everything else and eventually make a decision. So Carl, when you were in the SEALs, did your commanders poll test decisions?
No, actually, you know, and we had a saying while we were on the battlefield. It says, first, A, no good battle plan for survives its first shot. And two, which is a well-executed bad plan is that better than a poorly executed great plan. Yeah. And, you know, this is rings true and true. And I was just on Fox a little while ago. And what it was is people are so nervous that he's reckless. And this, I said, no, he's trying to get something in place, a blanket statement that says this fixes the problem. Exceptions and changes need to be made, but we'll deal with that later when the safety of the American public is not on the line.
Right. You were also on a CNN interview earlier in the week, and you absolutely destroyed former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. And you had this line where you said you can't write a law with a million exceptions right off the bat. And she was trying to tell you or convince you that somehow all of these incoming immigrants are somehow protected under the U.S. Constitution. And you nailed her because you said, look, they're not even here. They can't be under our constitutional laws. Our constitutional laws do not apply to somebody that is, A, neither a citizen, nor isn't even within our country boundaries.
Well, this is they're trying to make an emotional argument over on legal precedent, and it doesn't go. The issue is, and she said, well, they have a constitutional right. And I said, but they're not here. They're not green card holders. They're not citizens, so no, they don't. She goes, well, Carl, when they get here, they do. I'm like, but they're not here. And that's the circular argument they keep making. And when the left gets all bent up and they can't actually make a good argument based on the reality of their proposals. She says things like, well, Carl, I'm a lawyer. And my immediate thought is, well, then you should know.
Yeah.
But this is what we're fighting, is they know, which means that in her heart of hearts, she knows that what she is proposing or saying is not actually legally correct.
Well, she was correct in the sense that once somebody is here, the Constitution does protect them, even if they're not a citizen. We just interviewed another lawyer last week about that sort of thing, because there are these Islamic training camps, and oddly enough, they are protected by the Constitution. But like you said, if they're not here, then of course not. I mean, that's like saying our laws apply to somebody, a citizen of Saudi Arabia, while they're in Saudi Arabia.
Right. And look, I'm not an attorney. I don't even have an undergrad. But I understand that if you're not here, you're not a green card holder, you're not a citizen, you do not enjoy our constitutional guarantees.
Yeah.
That said, when you get here, whether you're a citizen or not, you're under the 5th and 14th Amendment. You are protected under certain liberties.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and of course, Trey Gowdy has been all over this as well. He's saying that American people deserve border security and interior security. They deserve to know who is coming to our country, for what purpose, and for how long. What is the difference in the type of vetting that we will want to do compared to what the Obama administration has done?
Well, here's the biggest thing that it blows my mind that people on the left can't understand this, but we don't have anything to vet them against. It's not like in America where everybody's given a birth certificate and then they're given a passport and they're given this and they're given that, and there's a paper trail of doctor's notes and, you know, what school you went to and what your grades were, like dating back to beyond when you were a kid. So there's an enormous paper trail in the United States of America on people. In foreign countries, many of which are on this new list of 7, there is no paper trail. So a guy could be a fighting age male, 25 years old, 30 years old, and have absolutely zero paperwork on who he is, where he came from, what he stands for, any history whatsoever. So this is what the left needs to understand. It's not that we don't want immigrants here. That's not it at all. We don't want immigrants that are going to destroy our way of life here. And when you have somebody who's 25 years old who had absolutely no history, and then the DHS guidelines said that you can't even look at his social media profile to make a decision, that's a problem to me.
Right, right. I saw, and I unfortunately don't have that right at hand, but I saw that there is discussion of perhaps going back to revet some of the refugees that have already come in. Do you know if that's true?
So, I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but the issue is there's so many refugees that are here that are supposed to be in certain places, and we go back to find them, and they're not there. So that holds a lot of weight because, I mean, keep in mind that we have our kids in schools. We have, you know, our family in different places. These are all dynamics that are greatly affected by the lack of knowledge of certain, you know, the presence of certain type of people in programs. Like, if we don't know where the people we just let into the country are after we say we vetted them, that's a real problem.
Yeah, yeah, that is a real problem, especially, like you said, when you go back and suddenly they're not there. That has to send chills down people's spine. All right, let's go and take a break. Coming back, we'll have more with Carl Higbee. Stay with us. And welcome back to the Ask My Brave Show. In our final segment now, we're talking with Carl Higbee. Higbee is spelled H-I-G-B-I-E if you're looking for him on Twitter or on Amazon. But we'll make all of that easier for you if you head to iSpyRadio.com. Today's show is 7:05. And one of the things that, that is concerning, anyway, that's been discussed is under Obama's administration that there were all of these people connected to the Muslim Brotherhood and CARE working in federal jobs. Do you know if there are plans right now with Trump's presidency to go back and look into some of those federal employees?
I would assume he would, but right now, I mean, like, he can't even get his own cabinet confirmed right now because of the opposition to the left. I mean, we gotta build our government up to Trump's standards before we start dilly-dallying with who we're looking at who's already in the mix. So the issue here is, we let in all these people. Nobody thought about how this was good for the United States of America. So now they're all here, and we have to do something with it. So it's a huge problem.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Well, you know, maybe the Democrats would respond if we started rioting in the streets and burning limos and attacking UC Berkeley. Maybe that would get their attention.
But that would be intolerant. You can't do that.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, the Business Insider is reporting that U.S. military officials approved Trump's first covert counterterrorism operation, where he bombed or had the SEAL team go in and take out that al-Qaeda base in Yemen. They say that as a result, three officials from the attacking SEAL team found itself dropping into a reinforced al-Qaeda base defended by landmine snipers and a whole bunch more. So apparently what they're trying to allege here is that the Trump team just didn't do enough research yet again, or get enough intelligence before they acted on this. Do you know if any of that's accurate?
No, here's the problem is Barack Obama was so risk averse. He avoided any and all conflict with any potential tragedy to any type of, to sway the public to think that he wasn't the most peaceful president in the world. What he did was he ignored the fact the bad guys were there, and now we have ISIS. It's Donald Trump is making risky decisions. Like these are tough decisions to make because you understand, and I mean you can see he went to go visit the body. This is what it weighs on him heavily. I've met the guy. I know how he thinks. These are decisions that do not come lightly to him, and he understands that he is the final say in that. But you know what? You have to weigh the value to the country and the value to the war. Are we going to have a few casualties now or many, many more later?
That's a good point. You know, you mentioned that Obama was risk adverse, and he tended to use just drones for most of his attacks in Yemen. I think from like the Jewish News or something like that. Anyway, we'll link it up on icemyradio.com. But it said that the entire time of Barack Obama's presidency, he only had two attacks on al-Qaeda that involved actual commandos on the ground. Does that shock you?
It does shock me, especially considering the guy dropped like 26,000 bombs during his second 4 years. So the problem is when you have a president who's not trying to actually win the war, he's trying to win a public affairs war, you're not going to have the same results as you have with someone like Donald Trump, who, by the way, the majority of the troops supported him in his presidency. I mean, like a lot of troops voted for him. The veteran vote really took him over the edge. Hmm. The other thing, too, is, you know, Barack Obama was unwilling to admit the real adversary here. Like, we can go to Yemen, we can go to Syria, we can go to all these places. And it's all Shia-backed Muslims by Iran, paid for, funded by, arranged by, taught by, trained by Iran.
Yeah.
We have to, at some point, be willing to step up and say that, Iran, you are the problem. I mean, I know recently they just launched this potential nuclear carrying ICBM. That is in direct violation. And Barack Obama just thought they were going to trust some handwritten thing. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it sends a very different message to organizations like al-Qaeda and ISIS and really the whole Muslim world there in the Mideast. It's one thing to be dropping bombs remotely, which to their mind, I would think, seems rather cowardly, versus actual boots on the ground and having some SEAL team members come in and kick your butt all over the place. And I think that sends a very different message.
It sends an incredibly different message. This is, you know, this administration, if you saw General Flynn, General Mike Flynn, if you saw his announcement yesterday, he's like, Iran, you're on notice.
Yes.
Walked off the stage. He's not happy. You can see it, that he is really angry about this. And he takes it very personally. And he takes the security of our nation very personally. And I know Mike Flynn very well. I speak with him fairly frequently. And he's a very good, very intelligent person that wants to rid threats to the United States of America. And the previous administration wasn't up to the task.
Hmm. No, they sure were not. And, you know, the other aspect that the mainstream media has been saying is they continue to try to call this ineffectual, although now we're learning that at least 14 militants were killed, and that they were able to retrieve laptops, cell phones, and thumb drives, and a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, that to me seems to be the real value of having troops on the ground versus just these drone strikes.
Right. And unfortunately, the price of having troops on the ground is potentially losing troops on the ground. Look, I was one of those troops on the ground. I completely understand this. And I understood it going into it. So we know what we're doing. We know what we're getting into. And we're happy to do it. But we don't want to do it if it's not going to have, you know, if they're not going to continue to fight the whole war. And that was the issue.
Yeah. I only got about a minute here with you. Now that Rex Tillerson is finally confirmed, what's your opinion of the U.S. Striking up a better relationship with Russia and some other countries to finally help fight ISIS?
I absolutely think it is. And the issue is nobody can win, especially in Syria, over ISIS without Russia and America being on the same page. There's seven or eight factions. You have, you know, the Kurds, the Turks, the rebels, the, you know, Russia, Iran, us, all these things moving there. And until the two major powers, Russia and America, get on the same page, whether it's leave Assad there or take him out, nothing's going to get solved.
Yeah, absolutely. Carl, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, great. Only enough time to quickly tell you to go visit iSpyRadio.com for the links mentioned during today's show. And while you're there, we do have a new feature. It's our iSpy Radio store, where we have all of our author's books listed there to make it a little bit easier to find. And don't forget to tell your friends and family about iSpy Radio. We certainly appreciate that. And just think about it. Every time you share iSpy, some liberal doesn't get his wings. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.